It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate, which is a fancy way of saying that every year at, at a given time, certain things take place, and those things repeat from year to year. And over the years, we've kind of kept track of those, and we're going to bring you kind of a synopsis of what to expect. In fact, I'm going to just cover a couple of things that are going to take place in August. And, of course, there's the usual stuff, like all of the goldenrods and asters are going to start to bloom and confuse us. But beyond that, I've been watching the hazel, and both the American hazel and the beaked hazel have a pretty good crop of nuts this year, which is amazing because last year they had a phenomenal crop of nuts, and here they are back again with a pretty steady crop. I've told you in the past that when the hazelnuts get ripe, they disappear, and it's a short period of time that they are on the trees. Last year, I saw hazelnuts for over a week, which was, you know, seems like almost no time at all, but a week. To have hazelnuts on the trees for a week is pretty phenomenal because usually it's a day or two. Once they're ripe, they're gone. And that date going back 22 years is the 15th of August, the average date. And it has been as early as August 7th in 2022, August 5th in 2023, and then for the most part it falls into the 16-18 I guess, let's see, where was it? Oh, the 22nd of August in 2003, which is about as late as I've ever seen hazelnuts on the trees, on the bushes. Some of the other things to look for in August, and you're going to start to see darners, big green darners that are going to get ready to migrate. Those are, the big green darner is a dragonfly. Black ash will begin to show some signs of color. Bottle gentians, a beautiful little blue flower that is fairly prominent along the shores of Prairie River, and there are some growing out on the islands in Pacagama Lake as well. Those are places where I've run into them. I'm sure that they are. You're going to find them around your place as well. It's a kind of a blue flower, about an inch and a half to maybe an inch and three quarters long. It's closed, that hence the name bottle gentian, and it's long and fairly narrow. So it's maybe, oh, let's say it's 3/8 of an inch wide, and it's maybe 2 inches or an inch and a half long. And the bees that pollinate it just forced their way in. Bees are, those female bees are pretty insistent when it comes to getting nectar. Bur oak acorns will be showing up. A grasshopper called the Carolina locust or the Carolina grasshopper is going to start to appear. You're going to see this grasshopper. It's got a sandy brown body. When it flies, the wings are black with a creamy colored border. They look like the wings of the morning cloak butterfly, but you don't see them except when the thing is flying. And what happens in August is that the males will hover about 3 feet off the ground over a female. The female will be on the ground, and the male will be flying in place right above her. And so you'll get a good look at the Carolina locust. Nighthawks will migrate around the 21st of August. Labor Day ants, those little red ants that are in your driveway right now, making those little volcanic little cones of sand as they pull up the gravel to make their homes. Those guys are going to enlarge that opening about three times, four times as big as it is now. And the elites, the females, and the winged females and the winged males are going to be released from the colony, and they will fly off and mate and carry on the ant colony. And those happen usually, I think my average date is around the 28th of August. And so they get the name Labor Day ants. You'll see the last of the deer flies. In most years, the deer flies are gone by the last week in August. If you have been like I have out with the deer flies, you'll be happy to see them disappear. Of course, asters will be blooming heavily during the month. Ghost pipe, that odd white chlorophyll-less flower, will come up and bloom in the woods. Usually find it under pines. It seems to like acid soils, but that happens in August. Start to see the end of the monarch migration, the fall population of mourning cloak butterflies. You haven't seen them all summer. They will emerge in the fall, and those will be the adults that will overwinter. Maples will begin to show some red leaves, averages the 11th, and the rose-breasted grosbeaks will migrate out. Speaking of migration, ruby-throated hummingbirds, the males, will be leaving by the middle of the month. The 15th is typically my last day, my average last day for sighting male ruby-throated hummingbirds. They're the ones, of course, with the red patch on their throats. So watch for that near the middle of the month. In the swamps, tawny cotton grass is going to start to bloom. It's going to come to seed, and you're going to see these white cottony fluffs out in the bogs, and that's going to be the tawny cotton grass coming to seed. So all of those things happen in August, and now just a quick rundown of some of the things that I have observed over the last week or so. I had tall blue lettuce, an interesting plant that grows very tall. I have one by my outhouse that's got to be 9 feet tall. Most of them are 5 to 6 feet tall. They have these tiny, well, say quarter inch flowers that look a bit like a daisy. It's a rayed flower, a composite. It's got rays around the outside, and then the flower is actually a little yellow dot in the middle. They have begun to bloom. Spotted touch-me-not jewelweed is blooming right now, probably at its peak. That's that orange trumpet-like flower. If you look, it's a bright orange flower. If you follow it back, it forms like a fish hook. It kind of hooks around like the letter J, and it's a hummingbird-pollinated flower. If you look carefully, you'll find these green seeds in there, green seed pods. If you touch those, you'll find out why it's called touch-me-not. Those are sort of loaded up and explosive, really. Once you touch them, they just the pod rolls up really quickly and the seeds go flying. Interestingly, that plant has had viable seeds on it for 3 weeks. And what happens there is that the plant, it's an annual, so it depends on those seeds to create next year's flower. And it can't always rely on there being a hummingbird to make the cross-pollination. So what happens is they put out a closed flower, a clistogamous flower, that is an absolute copy of itself. So the plant puts out a flower that it never really blooms. It doesn't look like the orange flower that you're going to see on the plant now. It's just a kind of a closed white structure that eventually will become a seed pod. Those seeds, because they're a copy of the plant and not cross-pollinated from another plant, those seeds will have less of a chance, or they will grow less robust plants because they are simply a copy of the plant that's already there. But the plant wants to cover its bets. And if it doesn't get that pollination from some outside source, from the flower next to it or one down the way a little bit where a hummingbird got in there, it won't get that real vibrant, you know, what happens when you bring in new genetic material. How this happens, that hook that I was telling you about, the hummingbird puts her beak in the flower, and then she sticks her tongue around the bend, and she gets down to where the nectar is, and she's licking the nectar. The flower, which is hung from the plant by a thin little thread, gently leans down and puts a dab of pollen on her forehead. And the flower, maybe that flower will be male if it's putting pollen on her. But that same flower in a day or two or four or five will change and become female. And so the hummingbird picks up flower or pollen from this flower, flies over to the next plant, and the same flower on that plant may be in its female state, in which case that same flower and the same action, she puts her beak in there, she runs her tongue around, she's drinking the nectar, flower is going to lean down and put and take the pollen off of her forehead, and cross-pollination and the guarantee of next year's plants. I saw my first flat-topped asters begin to bloom this last week, and they are white, and flat-topped is a good description because ultimately it's going to be a very uniform sort of flower structure, very top-heavy flower structure. Flat-topped is a good description. The other aster that I'm seeing blooming right now is one called Northern Heart-Leaved Aster, and that is a blue flower, and it's much, the flat-topped asters are usually 4 to 5 feet tall. The Northern Heart-Leaved Asters are 2 to 3 feet tall, and the heart-leaved aster, you need to look down the stem and in order to find the heart-shaped leaf that gives the plant its name. The leaves near the flower heads up high on the plant are not going to have the same structure. They're not going to have that heart shape. But if you look down the plant toward the bottom, you'll see a kind of a sort of a broad petiole, a sort of a winged petiole that comes out and meets with a very much heart-shaped leaf. So Northern Heart-Leaved Aster. Canada Goldenrod, or is it Tall Goldenrod? Well, here's what I can tell you about it. Let's see. This is from Minnesota Wildflowers. Contrary to popular belief, tall goldenrod appears to be the predominant species throughout the greater metro area, typically tolerating drier sites than Canada or giant goldenrod, and it, not Canada goldenrod, is usually the species you'll see completely filling up old fields or open disturbed areas. Tall goldenrod is hairy across the underside of the leaf, while Canada goldenrod is only hairy on the veins. Tall goldenrod is hairy across the underside of the leaf. Canada goldenrod is only hairy on the veins. So that might be the simplest way to determine if, in fact, you're looking at Canada goldenrod or tall goldenrod. I wasn't able to decide whether one was one or one was the other. By the way, Canada goldenrod, one day early in terms of its blooming. First flowers of the tall blue lettuce were right on time. So that kind of just went right where you'd expect it to be. I ran into a couple of plants in the water. I was down along the edge of the lake, and there are a couple of interesting plants that form in the water. One is common bladderwort. This is a bright yellow flower, and there are several, I think 8 different kinds of bladderworts in Minnesota, but common bladderwort is just that, common. And in this part of the state, if you are looking at these little yellow flowers that are going to be right practically on the surface of the water, and the flower itself is kind of pea-like or orchid-like, it's an unusual shape, and you're going to get really wet, or maybe your kayak or your canoe is going to be almost in the muck when you run into these guys. They are very close to shore in very shallow water. And although these common bladderworts, the commonly held view is that the bladder of the bladderworts are for capturing and digesting microorganisms that provide the plant with nutrients. The bladders are often observed to contain communities of microorganisms, bacteria, algae, and diatoms, living in the bladders, not as prey, suggesting that the bladders may also, and perhaps more importantly, serve as sort of a symbiotic community for these, for the plant, for the bladderwort. The other plant that's blooming right now in very shallow water is a plant called water shield, and this one is really interesting. It's got 3 petals, and three sepals. So when you look at it, you're going to think six, because the sepals and the petals are both the same color. On my lake, they're kind of a red, sort of tending toward pink. But the interior of that flower, where the stamens are, where the male parts are, and so you've got these six recurved petals and sepals forming sort of a, think of a king's crown, all right? And then in the center of that are the stamens, which stand up. And these are, there might be a dozen of them with these little reddish structures standing up in the middle of this water shield. Quite a beautiful little flower and very common. The leaf, which you are, if you have done any canoeing or kayaking and gone into shallow water on a lake, you'll be very familiar with the leaf. The leaf is about 4 inches. It is a almost perfect oval. And if you were to reach into the water and pick this leaf, you would find it really mucilaginous, which means snot-like. The underside of the leaf, the stem is going to be right in the center of that oval leaf. And that whole underside of the leaf and that stem are going to be kind of covered with this snot-like stuff. Yellow pond lilies are blooming pretty heavily. Fragrant water lily, the big white water lilies, are probably at their peak of bloom. Hazel and both beaked and American hazel are have abundant nuts on them this year. The large-leafed aster is blooming. And the large-leafed aster, if you've walked in the forest at all, you've seen these big leaves. They're like not as big as a pie, but they are quite large. And if you've ever found yourself out in the woods and in need of toilet paper and having forgotten to put some in your pocket before you left, these are often the first leaves that you would grab to substitute for toilet paper. The flower itself tends to be sort of intermittent. Not every one of those big leaves is going to put up a flowering stalk, but those that do, the flowering stalk is going to be 2-3 feet high. The flower is going to be blue and it's going to be incomplete. It's a aster, and asters belong to the composite flower family. Think sunflower or daisy. Daisy's probably a better one to put in your mind. You know, the white rays that stick out of the daisy with the yellow center. In this case, the rays are blue and the center is yellow. And in the case of the large-leafed aster, the rays of that flower are going to be incomplete, as though someone had come by and plucked a ray or two out of the flower head. So you'll see 3 or 4 rays and then a gap, and then 2 or 3 rays and then a gap, and then maybe 7 rays and then a gap. And so if the flower looks incomplete, as though somebody had plucked a few of the rays out, and it is blue and it is fairly tall, and if you look at the ground and see these giant leaves, you're probably looking at large-leafed aster. Common skullcap is blooming. Common arrowhead is blooming. Yellow loosestrife is blooming. Meadowsweet is blooming. Here's another note. This note, speaking of the Canada goldenrod, tall goldenrod and the closely related Canada goldenrod are very similar, and both have two recognized varieties in or subspecies. The two Canada goldenrod are variety canadensis and variety hagari, and altissima, and subspecies altissima, and subspecies gilvocanensis. You see what I go through. Some authors treat them all four varieties as single species. Canadensis and will always be a challenge to readily separate, while multiple other references all have their 2 cents worth. Our descriptions are based closely on those found in the flora of North America and based on our own field observations over time. Plants with involucres, the sets of bracts that are under the head, under the flower head, 2 to 3 millimeters long, are either canadensis or altissima. where Altissima subspecies Altissima has involucres of 3 to 4.5 millimeters long, blah, 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 blah. It goes on. The whole thing is just as confusing as can be. But I think if you remember to look at the leaf, look at the underside of the leaf when you're looking at these goldenrods that are in bloom right now. And these are the taller ones with the sort of typical goldenrod head on them. Look at the leaf. Look at the underside. If the hairs are only on the veins, it's Canada goldenrod. If the hairs kind of cover the bottom of the leaf, it's tall goldenrod. Not that it makes any difference. If you recognize them as goldenrods, hey, you're doing good. And they're in bloom right now, so get out and check them out. It's a wild place out there, and lots of stuff is happening, and we will be starting to see the spreading dogbane in my yard are beginning to turn yellow, so we are past the midpoint of summer. That's our phenology show for this week. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back again next week to confuse you with a whole lot more stuff.
You can check out KAXE.org for more phenology information and past stories, as well as a place to sign up for that Season Watch newsletter. It's written by our phenology coordinator, Charlie Mitchell. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer. John, we got a text from our friend Lisa. She said, John, your talk of the hummingbird tongue reminded me of witnessing that action. I had a drink in a purple double-walled tumbler with a matching straw. A hummingbird was attracted to the color, I guess, and sampled it through the straw. I could see its amazingly long tongue right through the straw.
Wow.
Huh.
Yeah.
Do you think there were adult beverages in there, and did that hummingbird get that?
One hopes.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, there actually, as I recall, there are two parts to the tongue that it split down the middle. And they're long, and think like little hairy filaments. Don't think of like the tongue in your dog or the tongue in your own mouth. Not at all like that. They are amazing, and they are as equally as long as the beak itself. So they can stick that baby out there quite a ways. It's
so
good for them.
Watch your purple tumblers and straws out there. You never know what hummingbird might need a drink.
Yeah, yeah. And so maybe go a little light on the gin if you're feeding the hummingbirds, because, you know, yeah, at their body weight, you know, an ounce and a half of gin in my body is one thing. An ounce and a half of gin in the body of a hummingbird is a whole nother thing. I think that hummingbird would be preserved. Yeah.